Marriage, that great estate, begins with the very best of intentions, usually anyway. We, of course, are familiar with forced marriages and things like that that can sometimes occur. Not so much in our day and in our place, but most people who get married that we know want to get married, right? And they have these dreams of this good future together. And we dream of this long life, this seemingly this endless bliss, the happily ever after kind of thing. Often that dream includes lots of kids, a big clean house, if you're my wife anyway. So there's this idealistic idea. There's nothing wrong with that. I appreciate the clean house. But we have this idealistic understanding when we embark on this adventure. The first three chapters of Hosea are about his marriage, which didn't quite end up the way most of us want our marriages to end up. They cover what is most likely the same territory. It's the same story. But these three very brief accounts are going to differ a little bit in terms of style. Okay, and so think of it in terms of watching the same event on Fox, CNN, and MSNBC. Okay, you'll get a very different feel for an event. If you do that. So that's sort of what this is similar to in some way, shape, or form. So here we have our couple, and they're dreaming about filling that house with little people and pets and who knows what. So anyway, let's start with, we're going to pick back up. Of course, we already looked at verse 1 many, many weeks ago when we started our historical introduction. So it was verse 2. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, he said to Hosea, okay, now that's interesting. Okay, he's talking about how he spoke through Hosea as Hosea being a prophet, but now he's saying something to Hosea. All right. In other words, this is going to be part of how he's going to speak through Hosea. Go, take yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom. For the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. So, this particular account of Hosea's marriage is written in the third person, and it is written in prose, not poetry. Okay? So this is News Station 1, third-person account, prose. The Lord began his ministry to Israel through Hosea with a command for Hosea. And it's not go and speak to these people, it's go and get married. Okay? This chapter has four commands in it, and they basically follow a similar pattern. The commands are followed by because. And so there's going to be a command, and then there's going to be an explanation of why that particular command. And so the first command that we see is, take yourself a wife. Very simple. Okay? It refers to the act of procuring a bride. Most men would understand, easier said than done, oftentimes. At least for me, it was very hard to take myself a wife. I don't know why she took me. So,
Ken is just biting his finger.
You know, he has no room to talk, though.
I just took my time, that's all.
So, but the problem is whom he is supposed to marry. She is supposed to be a wife of whoredom. And so we have a problem here. And anybody remember the movie?
Pretty Woman.
Pretty Woman. Okay. So some of you may not have remembered the movie. What's the storyline of said movie? Yes. But, huh? Yes. He hires her to go to some ritzy party, and they end up somehow falling in love. I never understood the magical fascination many people have with this film. While in Pretty Woman, it's a romantic comedy, and it's meant to be this feel-good sort of story at the end. There was no sort of feel-good story here for Hosea. Okay, he marries this wife of whoredom, literally a wife or woman of adulteries. It's a as Pratt notes, it's a plural of repetition or lifestyle, and so she's a woman of adulteries. Okay, not a woman who commits adultery, but just the way the Hebrew language functions. This indicates that this is who she is. It's not an act that she did once or twice, but it's a lifestyle for her.
Not to pick mints, but is the implication she's not your typical selling it for money kind of thing? In other words, she's just an adulteress versus a whore? I mean, or does it matter for the context?
That's unclear.
It's a lifestyle. She probably
got money. Yeah. What started probably as adultery resulted in whoredom, shall we say? Because when we go through Hosea, what we end up seeing is that she really is selling herself for money, just as the Israelites are selling themselves to the foreign gods for all the blessings. So, yeah. So, all right. How many of you initially kind of hear this and go, wow, you know, not thinking so much about you feel bad for Hosea, but this feels wrong. Okay. A lot of you are kind of going, yeah, this seems a little strange. And so there is a bit of a problem that lots of people have tried to solve. Regarding God's command to Hosea at this point in time. And so one of the ways in which people have gone to try and resolve this inner dissonance that we experience is to argue for what's called a hypothetical marriage. Calvin argues for this. Kyle, one of the famous liberal Old Testament scholars, you know, Kyle and Dalich have, you know, like the standard commentary on the Old Testament. E.J. Young also argues for this idea of a hypothetical marriage. In other words, there's a sense almost which God didn't really say this. God really didn't mean this. It was more trying to get us to imagine his pain, which is completely unsatisfying to me in every way, shape, or form. They are driven by their discomfort with God telling him to marry such a woman. But let us keep in mind, what do we know about Hosea? Do we know what he does? He's a prophet, but we don't know what else he is. Okay? What was the one thing an Israelite man was supposed to make sure of before he got married? Who can't he marry? Right. So couldn't marry outside the faith. Okay. I'll make sure I put the can't in there. Okay, so every Israelite man was under this one instruction that they were not to marry outside of Israel or outside of the faith. Okay. There are also instructions for the priests. Okay, anyone remember whom a priest had to marry? Yes, a woman.
Good
It's not Greece we're talking about over here. Okay? So priests had to be a virgin. Okay? She couldn't be a widow, for instance. Okay? Or someone who whose husband dumped her for any, you know, remember we have the rules for divorce. If anything was displeasing, he could send her away with a certificate. So he couldn't marry a woman who had a certificate of divorce or a woman who had been widowed. She had to be a virgin. Yes?
I mean, the priests were of the tribe of Levi.
Could right.
Could he marry outside that tribe?
I'm trying to remember. You would have to ask that question.
Because didn't the lineage move down from the wife, so would their children be him?
I'm not sure when the lineage from the wife thing came into being, but it's not a biblical concept.
In the Old Testament, it would be the man, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And in the New Testament, we see the lineage from Mary for Jesus, mm-hmm. but before that, I don't think we ever did see.
No, it's always tied to the man. Right.
Mary, is that an anomaly that they would put her lineage in there?
Yes.
Just for
yes.
these circumstances.
So, I can't pull up the data in my brain right now about whether or not they had to be from the tribe of Levi.
It seemed like,
sorry,
because they're so strict about things
that
she might have had to be from the tribe of Levi.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
I remember. So, you know, we have but we do have the standards for priests in Leviticus 20, verse 7, 21, verse 7, and the great high priest, Leviticus 21, verse 13. If anyone wants to quickly look that up and verify any of that, that's fine. But keep in mind here that God is not commanding Hosea to commit adultery. Okay, I think that's where some of this discomfort comes in, is that people misunderstand what is being commanded here, and God is not commanding that she commit adultery.
Leviticus 21:12-14.
Yeah.
A widow or a divorced woman or a woman who has been defiled or a prostitute, these shall not marry.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say anything about
children. Okay.
Just said, only a virgin from his own people.
No, from his own people.
Yeah, and then that could be, yeah, Israel. Yep. So, where am I? There I am. Let's also keep in mind that many of the prophets performed symbolic actions, what we could say as the word made visible. For example, Hosea, who was a contemporary of, Isaiah, who was a contemporary of Hosea. One of the things he was commanded to do was walk around naked and barefoot for 3 years in order to symbolize the coming exile. Okay, one would think, particularly in light of Genesis 3, that would be a very bad thing, and yet God commanded him to do this. We see Ezekiel years later was commanded to lie on his side and cook bread over dung to symbolize the coming siege of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. Now, this is one of those interesting passages where everyone, you know, if you go to the store now, you find Ezekiel bread, and it's the bread with the recipe that Ezekiel received in to make this particular bread, and everyone kind of rips this out of the context that it's given, meaning this is the bread of exile, this is the bread of siege, it's supposed to be lousy bread, not really good for you kind of bread, and it was cooked over dung, okay, which meant that it was ceremonially unclean. Yes, yes. If they had water buffaloes, but they didn't, but, cow chips, that kind of stuff. So, or sheep dung or something. So, let's not think that the bread that he ate was a good thing. Don't be deceived by the ads. All the stuff you see. So we see that sometimes God, to make his point, doesn't just speak, but has his prophets act. And as we can see, some of these can be prolonged actions. For Isaiah, I mean, it was 3 years he's doing this. You know, who signs up for that job? Hey, Steve, why don't you walk around naked for 3 years, barefoot, to symbolize the fact that these people are going to be dragged off barefoot and naked to Babylon. Okay, I would probably say, can you find another dude for this thing? And if I were to disrobe now, I would be fired, right? Pretty much. So there are things that God has commanded prophets to do in the Old Testament that which we would be uncomfortable doing or seeing. Okay, so. The fact that God is commanding Hosea to do something that you would be uncomfortable doing or watching a friend do is not really part of the data. So we can't just make this some hypothetical marriage, you know, for God to use, you know, like a song to make a point. Okay, so that's the first view, the hypothetical marriage. And I find it a very unsatisfying view. The second view is called the harlot view. And this is that he married someone he knew was a harlot and quite possibly a temple prostitute. And so this would be a picture of a temple prostitute. However, what we find is that the words commonly translated temple prostitute are not used in this context. And he would be commanded to marry someone that already was impure. And so this doesn't seem to be a very good view either. I think this is not what happened. The third view that is given is what's called the idolatrous view. Not the adulterous view, but the idolatrous view. And that is that she worshipped false gods when he met her. And so we see that interaction of the spiritual and the physical. Her idolatry is represented here by adultery, okay? But this doesn't really solve the controversy, used loosely, since he would be forbidden from marrying an unbeliever, okay? So this doesn't remove us from a moral quandary, so to speak, okay? So the idolatrous view doesn't seem to really do justice to what's going on. The fourth view is called the proleptic view. How's that for a great word? P-R-O-L-E-P-T-I-C. So, proleptic. Okay. And this view is that she was sexually pure prior to marriage, okay? And that this is really, in a sense, seen from hindsight. And so, God is telling her to marry this woman. God knows that this woman is going to end up being an adulterous woman. Lo and behold, it comes true, okay? But Hosea writes about it after it's all transpired. And so he now knows this is an adulterous woman, and he now knows that the children that are going to come from her are going to be children of her whoredom or adultery. So now there's a fifth view. See, I tricked you. Ha, ha, ha. That's called the hybrid view. The plural abstracts, woman of adulteries, that thing, okay, denotes an inner characteristic, her bent towards immorality. After marriage, this came to fruition through adultery. And God essentially gave Hosea a heads up about it. I mean, it wasn't like she was already running around with everybody in town, or that she'd even run around with anybody in town, but that there had been sort of some of the warning signs that this might be part of her heart. You know, maybe she read the astrology column in the local gazette and, you know, initially thought it was just, oh, for fun. You know, I don't know. I was just kidding with that. But there were maybe some indications that maybe her heart really didn't belong to God, that she was sort of playing the game. And then God essentially lets Hosea know that this is not going to be an easy ride. And then it all explodes, so to speak, in her immorality, and as well as her idolatry. Okay. After marriage, I already said that. As we read about Hosea's family, we are to think of Israel as God's family. Okay. And so Hosea, in this living parable, represents God, while Gomer represents Israel, okay? And the kids are the future generations of Israelites. His marriage is a very real marriage, but it would become a symbol or metaphor for his ministry. In a sense, it is the way in which he is going to speak to the people of Israel. This sounds bad, but he is to have children of whoredom with her. The grammar indicates that, like Gomer, they will be known for their whoredom or adulteries. God knows exactly what they were like, and he knows exactly what you are like. Okay? And I'm not talking just about, oh, God knows the... you know, exactly what the people of Israel at the time of Hosea were like. I mean, you know, way back when, okay, even if we're not talking about from eternity, all right, but even at the time of the Exodus, or if you want to go farther back, the calling of Abraham, he knew exactly who these people were, exactly what they would be doing, the depths to which they would fall. He took to himself an adulterous bride. Okay. And lest we be too hard upon them, let us remember that the church is at times an adulterous bride for Jesus, because she is prone to wander, prone to leave the one that she loves. As one of my professors would say, you know, that idea of the church as your mother. You can't have God as your father without the church as your mother. My mother is a whore, but I still love her. Okay? And who's the mother? It's us, in a sense. That is us. So.
Is this a sixth view where she's simply hook or get over it, or does that go back to the Highland view?
Well, I mean, it's the hybrid view. I'm still sticking with the hybrid. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I mean, the fullness of her of Israel's adulteries were not revealed here at the Exodus, but we see some early struggles, but they come to greater and greater fruition and problems over the life of their time with him. So.
Do we know anything about Didleen?
We'll get there. Okay. I think I've got something there. Somewhere. We don't know much about it, though. It's most likely the name of a place, but not one that we're familiar with, as opposed to the name of her father. Okay. It could be either one of those two things. That's normally how people are called.
It seems like, you know, a wife of whoredom... Could, like, what if the parents were the ones who committed adultery?
You know,
the child actually still be a wife of whoredom.
Mm-hmm. And oddly enough, no one ever mentions that. That's a very, very good thought. I don't know why no one really thinks about it that way.
Sort of living out the sins of the parents.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, she's sinning.
Yeah, she falls into the same sin that her parents did.
Which is really,
quite truthful, because I was going to say, I think one reason why we squirm at this whole idea of God telling her him to marry a harlot is because of the, I think, unbalanced man-sided view of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And that all through history, sort of chauvinistic view that men have of women.
Mm-hmm.
The double standard.
Yeah. Particularly in that day and age.
In a fallen state, I don't mean at all.
Yeah.
Totally plagued by that, but we bring it into our Christianity, regardless of whether it's true or not.
Yes, where young men who are promiscuous are seen as virile, and that's what you're supposed to do. That's a good thing. But the women are castigated and looked down upon. The double standard that we see in a sinful world. We should not. So.
Are we over?
So would this be called the "It's My Parents' Fault" view?
No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't.
Are we trying to insert, however well-intentioned, our idea of what God must be? I mean, are we forgetting he hardens hearts?
Mm-hmm.
And he smites people. And mm-hmm. he chooses one over another, mm-hmm. to us arbitrary, but it's his decision. Why do we feel the need to defend a decision to tell him to go out and marry him?
Because,
it violates his law.
Yeah.
Which I guess is God's prerogative.
While God ordains sin, he does not command sin. And so there needs to be an understanding of what's going on, so that we're not opening up the door for saying that God is the author of this particular sin.
I hear you, but even when you defend it by saying she wasn't a whore at the time, but she was going to be, well, God knew that.
Mm-hmm.
So, what is that, a loophole?
Well, yeah, it's sovereignty in a sense.
That's where I'm trying to go. It's sovereignty in action. Maybe we don't need to get hung up on defending it so much as it is what it is. Roll with it. Yeah.
Really, none of these views leave me all too satisfied. For they all try to seem to make a lot of mental gymnastics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the text. I mean, it really, if God is telling someone to do that, God also told Abraham to kill his son.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that, are you, like, the time being, can God decide, I'm going to tell you to do something because I'm telling you it is not going to be sinful? I don't know. not that you're going to be, able
right.
to answer whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even with Abraham and Isaac, I mean, God knows he's. You know, this is a test. Okay, so it's not like God changed his mind. It's like, did I really tell him to kill the child of promise? Golly, I better rescue that kid. But it was to see the heart. To reveal the heart of Abraham, not so that God would know, but so that Abraham would know, and that we, for whom it was written, would know. And that God would provide a picture of redemption through that whole event. So God, of course, ordaining the beginning from the end, and the end from the beginning, blah, 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 all that, you know, all that stuff, has a much fuller understanding of all of this than we do. And so we're trying to grapple, I think, with who she was at the point of marriage. Because that is sort of significant. Did he go and just find a temple prostitute? Or did he find a woman that was going to become essentially like a temple prostitute? But God is ordaining this precisely to be an illustrative picture for his people. This is the main message of Hosea's ministry. So,
like Abraham, though, we see that Hosea is obedient. He obeys
yes.
what God has commanded him to do.
Yeah. So, he takes a woman who's going to break his heart a million times. So, let's see. I covered that. This is in a sense is interpreted for us. The land Israel commits great whoredom by forsaking God. Right there at the end of verse 2. For the land, which represents Israel, commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So there's the reason for this. Okay, the issue is forsaking Hosea for lovers, just as Israel forsook the Lord for other gods. So we see that the northern kingdom, Yahweh charges, has become a brothel nationwide. The people have lapsed into egregious violations of their covenant with Yahweh. So,
was it the sin that they committed was not only idolatry, but immorality in the idolatry, was it not?
Yes.
So maybe that's a double.
Right, because they're leaving him for the fertility gods. And an essential aspect of their worship was sexual immorality. So it's a double thing, which we kind of lose. When we think about idolatry, we don't tend to necessarily connect it with the actual act of adultery. Okay? Because very few of our gods demand that. You know, some of our false gods... if you're serving the idol of pleasure, yeah, okay, but you may not be serving that idol in that particular way. You could be serving that idol through food or alcohol or any number of different ways. So let's go back to Exodus 34 for a moment. And God knew all this, okay, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land. And when they whore after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and you are invited, you eat of his sacrifice, and you take of their daughters for your sons, and their daughters whore after their gods, and make your sons whore after their gods. You know, the best way to get a man to go into idolatry would be to give him a wife who goes into idolatry. And some people, of course, try to practice the opposite way. Some women will marry a man thinking that they can make him a godly believer out of a man who's not. So, anyway. In a sense, yes. He had that choice. Do I follow my wife into sin or do I remain with God? And he chose to follow his wife into sin. Forgetting that, of course, the same God who gave him Eve could give him another woman. So we like to justify our sin in any way, shape, or form that we possibly can. He sinned again out of fear. Okay. Deuteronomy 31, and the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers. Then this people will rise and whore after the foreign gods among them in the land that they are entering, and they will forsake me and break my covenant that I have made with them." So, here it is. Moses is on his deathbed. He's about to lie down, and talks about how they're going to rise up and commit all kinds of sin. So it was not a secret that not a surprise to God that this happened. Israel... And these kind of cases we see essentially is portrayed as God's bride. Whoredom doesn't make sense apart from that reality. Okay, her adulteries don't make sense unless she's married to somebody, and spiritually she was married to God. She is in covenant with him and is meant to display fidelity just as he displays fidelity. Okay, the land of Israel broke that covenant just as Gomer broke her marriage covenant. Hosea was obedient to the command of God, and he marries Gomer, daughter of Diblaim. Okay, let's talk a little bit about this. Gomer is formed from the root GMR, actually Gimel. My brain just decided not to function. But anyway, meaning to bring to completion. Okay. In Hebrew, you have the consonants, and usually a verb is going to have three consonants. So here we have the G, M, R. And what happens is the vowels change based on whether it's a noun or a verb, and whether it's, you know, what kind of verb and how it functions, you know, the conjugation of the verb, all that fun stuff. So what remains constant is the consonants. What changes is, of course, the vowels. So one of the joys of Hebrew. So if you ever want to study it, you'll have lots of fun. Okay. Actually, I preferred Hebrew over Greek because at least in Hebrew, there's word order. There's structure to a sentence. In Greek, it's insanity. You could have this long, especially with Paul, humongous sentences, and it's all over the stinking place.
Give us some examples of how the word Gomer would change.
Off the top of my head, no. That's an unfair question, I say.
So maybe she was really a demon.
Hmm?
Maybe she was really a demon.
Oh.
That would explain a lot.
And we're moving on right now. We're moving on. That little bunny is going back in the hole. Where was I? Yes, okay. To bring to completion. And so she has a sense of symbolic name. You know, God is going to bring to completion the judgment upon the northern kingdom.
I thought God meant
so.
Woman.
No.
What means woman?
Isha is woman in Hebrew. Gune in Greek. So you may be confusing gune. No? Okay. Diblaim may be a place, not a person, since it seems to be the plural for a raisin cake. Okay. Although, you know, and we'll see raisin cakes popping up.
It might be, but it was often
connected with. Wow, I've lost you guys completely today. Am I in middle school? I've lost control of the room. Raisin cakes were often connected with the idolatrous worship of the people around them. So that could lend itself towards what Brian had said earlier. Yes, Mark?
I thought polygamy was the word Gomer as a root. That's what it was.
Oh, but that's out of Greek.
Pardon me?
That's out of Greek.
It's a Greek word?
Yeah, we get that, yeah, polygamy would be taken from the Greek, not from Hebrew. So in terms of word derivation. Okay. So they're commonly used as a symbol, and you know, here's the idolatrous worship. We don't see any raisin cakes there, but or not that we can see. You know, maybe. Yeah, what's going on there? But the false immoral worship. Okay, we're going to see this again in chapter 3, verse 1. For instance, the implication here is that she did have a son with Hosea, but perhaps the other children were not conceived by Hosea. Okay, because we're going to read there's a change. Okay, here it says, she conceived and bore him a son. In the other places, it's going to, the bore him part is not going to be there. Okay, so, excuse me. So as we think about all of this in a context, we see, as I think Dierman notes, that bizarre behavior is thus not out of the question for prophetic signs. Okay, so this sounds bizarre to us, but we're dealing with prophets here, people. Okay? All right, let's press on. All right. And the Lord said to him, about this child that she bore to him, call his name Jezreel. For in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. And I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow, of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So just a little hint, you may not want to name your kid Jezreel. It was not a good name. Okay? He's commanded to name him Jezreel, or, as it means, God sows or scatters. Okay? This naming is a sign for the coming judgment upon Israel. Okay? So this is one of the commands, and they have the reason why. He is going to scatter Israel. It was the name of a valley in the heart of the northern kingdom. It was also the name of a prominent city during Omri's dynasty, and that city was near Mount Gilboa. And what's significant is that King Ahab had a palace there in Jezreel. We see this in 1 Kings 21. And it was there that Ahab's family was assassinated, as we see in 2 Kings chapter 9. So he had a palace, and when Jehu came, after he had been anointed king to bring judgment upon the house of Omri, he killed Ahab out in the plains, but he killed Jezebel and others in the city of Jezreel. So, and so as a result, the city or plain had the connotation of God's judgment. And here it's anticipating a future judgment that shall fall upon the house of Jehu. Okay? Jehu's dynasty will suffer the same fate, but worse. Okay? The end of his house, but also the end of Israel's house. Okay? They will cease to exist as a geopolitical entity. Jehu, way back in 2 Kings 9, was God's instrument against Omri's house, but he went too far. Okay? In his bloodlust, he also killed the king of Judah. He was only supposed to kill the son of Omri, but he went a little nuts. So, and so God will put an end to the bloodthirsty line of Jehu, as well as Israel, for its many sins. His line would end in murder in 752. There would be 30 years of seemingly endless coups until Assyria came and squashed the whole deal. Okay? So, the broken bow, which is one of the treaty curses that we saw in Deuteronomy, points to a great military defeat as part of their judgment. Okay, there's not going to be a plague. It's not going to be, you know, some infectious disease that wipes them all out or something like that. It's going to be military defeat. In 733, Assyria would defeat Israel in the valley of Jezreel and send many of the residents to exile. And then 11 years later, Assyria would return to destroy its rebellious vassal. And so we see it kind of taking place in parts. You know, they're defeated. This vassal king is sort of, you know, the puppet king is sort of set up. And then, you know, within 11 years, The kings of Assyria are so completely fed up with these puppet kings, they just come and squash them completely and send everybody into exile and don't have to deal with these crazy people anymore. Okay? That's sort of what happens. So, whenever God is not fully trusted and obeyed exactly, including the realm of politics, his people deny the adequacy of his care and protection so that they fend for themselves on their own terms. And we can see that today. Just how a lot of Christians in this country, political expediency is running things. And people are making choices about the lesser of two evils and all of that fun stuff. So, the events of 2 Kings 10 are a welter of trickery, butchery, and hypocrisy, in which the only trace of a religious motive, fanaticism. Jezreel was only one episode of a continuous story, and God could be no party to it. Derek Kidner notes from his commentary. So, what time do we have since that clock is way off? 10:02. Okay. We're good. She conceived again and bore a daughter. Okay, yeah, that personal pronoun is sort of missing. So this indicates to us that most likely the daughter's father was someone besides Hosea. Okay. And the Lord said to him, call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. But I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen. So a second child is conceived by Gomer. This time it's a daughter. As I mentioned, this slight change would indicate that this was not his child, that she did not bear it to him. Hosea is commanded to name her Lo Ruhamah. Okay? If you want your quick little Hebrew lesson, Lo means no. Okay. So Ruhamah is mercy. No mercy. This is not like Roberto Duran. No mas. No mas. No mercy. Hosea's, and so, you know, you're kind of wondering, does this mean that there's now no mercy toward Gomer? Maybe he's kind of caught her before, and now there's a child by it, and, you know, he kind of is fed up as well. We're not sure. But the reason that is given in the text is that the house of Israel will receive no more mercy from the Lord. This means, of course, that she has been enjoying lots of mercy, but that mercy had not led to her repentance. God, whose nature it is to forgive, Exodus 33, will no longer forgive this rebellious people. This is the second declaration of judgment upon the nation, meaning God is serious. It's similar to this little scene here from the Godfather, where he says to Fredo, you are dead to me. Okay? God is basically saying, you're dead to me. I'm going to utterly destroy you. Okay? Israel is here contrasted with Judah, the southern kingdom. Judah will continue to receive mercy by the hand of God. They will be saved. Okay? But let's think of that in terms of rescued. Okay, this is within the context, stop playing with those, of Assyria. Okay? So Assyria is going to destroy Israel, but Assyria is not going to destroy Judah. Okay? But they're not going to be saved by their military power or prowess. they're going to be saved by God himself. Okay? And we see that this happens in the scriptures. Sennacherib comes. He lays siege to Jerusalem. He sends his emissary to mock the Lord. And while all of the Judahites are huddling sort of in Jerusalem, wondering, oh, how's this all going to unfold? We kind of see this in Isaiah. Kind of, by night, God sends the destroyer, and 185,000 Assyrians are destroyed without the Israelites shooting an arrow or swinging a sword. So, some have viewed verse 7 here as an editorial comment or a redaction, not part of what Yahweh says. I tend to think that it is what he said. Because the idea of the redactor, the editor, is usually brought in by liberal scholars who don't believe in the reality of prophecy. Okay, so, you know, some guy kind of came along later and said, oh yeah, let's clarify this, based on what they knew already happened, as opposed to God speaking to Hosea about what's going to happen. So, I'm in the going to happen crowd. So Israel is destroyed by Assyria, but Judah, while ravaged, did not fall to Assyria. So the joy of fatherhood was deeply clouded, and the children were living proof of the invasion of their marriage. Doug Stewart notes that Israel, more thoroughly corrupted by syncretism, would fall first under Assyria. So I think we're finishing today, babies. Let's go. When she had weaned, no mercy, lo ruchamah, she conceived and bore a son. And again, we see the same formula as we do with lo ruchamah. And the Lord said, call his name not my people. There's the lo again. And it's not Amy. It's lo ami. Possessive suffix, and this is so that means my, and am is people. So no or not my people. So okay. For you are not my people, and I am not your God. Okay, so Yahweh is not done talking about the judgment to come upon the land of Israel. This is the third time. Emphasis, okay? And that's how Israel, you know, Hebrew functions. Repetition for emphasis. Whoops. Repetition. Okay? That's why, you know, holy, holy, holy is not that the guy's stuttering. Okay, but it's meant to be holiest. Okay, so the superlative is the triple repetition of something. Okay, so here we have that they're getting judgment to the fullness of judgment is going to come upon Israel. Yeah.
Just going back to verse 2, where that word whoredom is repeated three times in that one verse,
mm-hmm.
Gomer, and also about Israel.
So, mm-hmm.
You know, to kind of, if there's one thing that the writer, that Hosea and God through Hosea wants these people to know, it's how bad this is.
Yes. Whores, whores, whores. Okay. Yes, we have the. This is a sense the defining characteristic of the Northern Kingdom is their idolatry and adultery. And so, what God is going to do is bring complete judgment upon them. So, Gomer conceives again, bears a son. Once again, the name comes from God. Lo ami. Not my people, precisely because they are not his people, and he is not their God. They're following other gods. That's the point. Could also reflect again, that this is not Hosea's son. He's basically saying to her, not my son. Okay? I know it's not my son. I don't know where the red hair came from. No, I don't, you know, no idea. Obviously not. And this is possibly him casting Gomer out. Okay? In contrast to the promise to Abraham and the Mosaic covenant as well. What was part of the great promise? It wasn't the land. It was, I will be your God and you will be my people. Okay? Some folks get really caught up about, oh, the land. No. My people. And this is, in a sense, an undoing of the covenant promise. Because they have rejected him in such a profound way that he is now rejecting them. They are not his people because he has not shown mercy, precisely because there was no repentance for their sin. Since we continue to sin, we are only his people because he continues to show us mercy in Jesus Christ. Children were not usually weaned until at least 2, quite possibly older. Sometimes I've seen some people saying, you know, as old as 6. So some of the radical people today who their kids are, you know, almost teenagers and they're still nursing them. It's bizarre to me. So this process would have taken at least, you know, probably 6 years. This is not obviously something that happened in a fortnight. This is a long process. But we see this progression that takes place. You know, judgment, no mercy, not my people. Okay? Kind of an upping of the ante, a greater revelation of what's going on. And so we see that Hosea's home life became a living sermon. Hosea's was lifestyle evangelism in the most appropriate sense. God's love for sinners does not make any sense apart from his free and sovereign grace. So, there you have it. As everyone leaves, as the choir departs. So, all right. For those of you who are remaining, it's only one after. Are there any questions? Oh, you're right. All right, let's pray then. Father, we ask that you'd humble us by this message. And that being humbled, we'd be filled with joy at the riches of your grace and mercy in Jesus Christ. That we would have a greater understanding of our own hearts and our own tendency to be distracted from you by the Vanity Fair in which we live. That the deceitful and fleeting pleasures of sin sometimes find a response in our hearts. And that you're not just talking about them back then, but you're talking about us too. And so that we would have a greater appreciation of how dependent we are upon mercy and our union with Jesus Christ. That there's nothing we contribute to either our conversion nor our remaining in grace. But we are wholly dependent upon you and what you have done for us in Jesus Christ. And so, also grant us that confidence that the work of Jesus is sufficient so that it would indeed prompt us towards greater repentance when we see the ways in which our hearts go astray. And so we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.